Hi, everyone. I'm with Kathleen Martin. She is a UFO abduction researcher, author, and lecturer. How are you doing, Kathleen?
I'm fine, thanks. Great. Nice to be with you today.
Yes, thanks so much for meeting up with me. And it's lucky we're not all that far apart. I live up in Maine, and you're down here in Massachusetts for the summer, so it worked out great.
Yes.
Yeah. Years ago, I remember when the movie came out in 1975, The Interrupted Journey.
It was the UFO incident based upon the book The Interrupted Journey by John G. Fuller.
Right. And Betty and Barney Hill. Now, Betty was your aunt.
Yes, she was.
Yes. I would consider both that abduction and Travis Walton the most solid abductions that I know of, anyway.
I agree with you.
Yeah.
Yes.
I'd love to have Travis on the show. We've had some conversation back and forth, but hopefully he'll be on soon.
Well, he's a great guy, so yeah. I hope he comes on your show.
Yeah, yeah. I want to ask you, first of all, now that happened in 1961, and I want to find out what it was like for you to first hear about this from your aunt, and how did all that come about?
Well, my aunt was my mother's oldest sister. Mm-hmm. They were very close. So when Betty and Barney returned home after having a close encounter with a very large, silent, hovering disc that was definitely not from this planet, Betty called my mother. And wow. I was seated in the same room.
Really?
It was September 20th, 1961. So I overheard their conversation. Then my mother filled me in on what Betty said. And within 2 days, my family went to Portsmouth. And firsthand, I heard the story and I saw some of the evidence as well.
Wow, the car?
I saw the spots on the trunk of the car, yes, very mm-hmm. shiny concentric circles that caused a compass needle to spin and spin.
Wow. And at that point, I know under hypnosis, they really became shook up and stuff. How was she at that point at first?
At first, she was very concerned and excited as well. This was something entirely new to her. She and my uncle had never read anything on the topic, had never had an interest in the topic before. She was very curious and concerned also about the possibility of contamination because that craft hovered only 100 or 200 feet above them. So they were very concerned about that.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know there's a lot of misinformation out there about this case. Just for the odd chance that someone might be listening in Europe somewhere that has never heard the story in its entirety, it's the first known abduction case, a landmark case, I would say. Can you, in a nutshell, explain the whole situation?
Yes. Betty and Barney were returning home from a brief vacation. They were driving during the night because there was a hurricane coming up the coast, and they wanted to return home before the hurricane struck. They were driving through upstate New Hampshire when they saw a new light in the sky. The odd thing about it was that it was flying very rapidly upward, and Betty attempted to identify this. In all, they got out of the car 3 times to look at this craft as it came in closer and closer. It finally surged ahead and hovered directly over the top of their vehicle, causing my uncle to have to stop the car. He got out of it, took his binoculars and his pistol as well, looked up at it as this huge disc hovered only about 100 feet above him. It shifted location to an adjacent field, and there he looked at it through binoculars and observed 9 to 11 figures looking down at him. The craft then tilted a little bit in his direction as most of those beings went to what appeared to be a panel on the back side of the circular hallway in the craft that went around the circumference of the craft. One remained at the window, and it seemed to hold a special attraction for Barney. It stared down, and this being's appearance caused Barney to become terribly frightened. He knew immediately that it was somehow not human. He had full conscious recall of observing these beings from the tops of their heads down to their knees. He could see that they were dressed in black, shiny uniforms. They moved in unison. They were, as I said before, not human. The one staring down at Barney caused him to feel that he was about to be captured, he said, like a bug in a net. Mm. And he became terribly frightened, broke away, and ran back to the car, screaming to Betty that they had to get out of there or they were going to be captured. The craft then shifted location from the field to just above their car as Barney went speeding down Route 3, which was the major highway at that time in northern New Hampshire. The craft was hovering over the top of the car. Betty rolled down the window and looked up, and all she could see was blackness. It was like a black void. Mm. She should have seen the stars. She should have seen the moon. It was a bright, starry night, but she didn't. And she and Barney later realized that the craft was hovering just above their vehicle. This is when they heard a series of code-like buzzing sounds that seemed to be striking the trunk of the car. They caused the car to vibrate and for a tingling sensation to pass through Betty's and Barney's bodies. The next thing they knew, they found themselves 35 miles south on Route 3. They had very, very little recall for what happened in the interim. They were startled awake by a second series of these beeping or buzzing sounds, and they recalled that they had encountered a roadblock somewhere along the way. They didn't know where or when. They also recalled observing a fiery orb in the road. And Barney remembered that it seemed to be moving, but he wasn't moving. It was very, very perplexing. He and Betty then continued on home. They really were seeking human contact. It was the middle of the night. They couldn't find a restaurant that was open. Mm. And so they just drove to their home in Portsmouth. And when they arrived, they realized that they were later than they had anticipated, even allowing for those three stops. It would be 2 months before they retraced that route and discovered that it was a full 2 hours that they were missing.
Wow. Boy, you know, I just learned a few things that I didn't know that was really interesting. Now, I know Carl Sagan wrote something on this, and there was a lot of conjecture up on his part that Stan Friedman tried to correct but did not get corrected. Has there been a lot of publications out there with misinformation about this?
Yes, there has been an incredible amount of misinformation regarding this case. I have all of the original records, all of the investigation reports, and the original statements made by Betty and Barney. So I have documented evidence of what was correct and what was not correct information. And I used that information when I wrote the book Captured, the Betty and Barney Hill UFO Experience. My purpose in writing that, one of my purposes, was in order to set the record straight, to separate fact from fiction regarding their case.
Now, did you write that with Stan?
I wrote about 85% of the book. Mm-hmm. Stanton Friedman wrote two chapters, one on the star map. He was instrumental in that investigation. And also he wrote one called Disbelievers and Disinformants. He also served the very important purpose of vetting my work for accuracy. And I wanted to know that that book was entirely unbiased. And in fact, he commented that he was pleased that I was willing to show Betty warts and all.
now that the star map that she wrote, that's an incredible story that, wasn't it an astronomer that actually figured that out later on or something like that?
Well, first let me tell you a little bit about the star map. When Betty was on the craft, her examination had been completed, and she was left alone in the room with the person that she calls the leader. We know today that that is the escort. Abduction experiencers see that person over and over again as they're abducted. But she said to him, in sort of an understatement, "Well, I know you're not from around here. Where are you from?" And so he produced a three-dimensional star map. It appeared sort of like a holographic image. And on that star map, there were a couple of large circles about the size of nickels, and then there were smaller circles. And they were connected, some by solid lines, some by dots. And under hypnosis with Dr. Benjamin Simon, Betty was instructed to draw that star map if she could remember it accurately and if it didn't trouble her too much. Mm-hmm. She went home and almost through automatic writing, you might say, she drew that star map. It was published in John Fuller's Interrupted Journey, and Marjorie Fish, who is a brilliant woman from Ohio and an amateur astronomer, saw that map. She was highly skeptical, but she reasoned that if that place actually existed in our galaxy, she might be able to find it. So she set out to do just that. In all, she built 26 models of our local galactic neighborhood out 55 light years, looking for the location of the stars on this map. She thought she would have many finds. In the end, there was only one.
Wow.
The great difficulty she faced is that the astronomical catalogs were not readily available to her, so she had to go to the university and hand copy all of the distance data. And then she went back to her home and constructed these models. Imagine the math alone that she did to put every star in its proper location. And in 1972, she finally had a match, and only one match after looking for several years. The interesting thing about that match was that all of the stars on Betty's map were sun-like stars, although only 5% of the stars in that neighborhood were sun-like.
Wow.
She only found that match after three stars were listed in that catalog that had not been listed in other catalogs. We didn't even know about them back when Betty drew that map.
Wow, that is totally amazing. Now, let's go back to where she contacted your mother and you went to the house and all that. How long was it before she actually reported it, and how did she go about reporting the incident?
Betty reported the incident on the evening that they arrived home from their trip. She had contacted my mother, and the former chief of police in Newton, New Hampshire, was at the house. He was my father's best friend, and he would stop by for coffee on his way home from work. So she told him about that, and he said that Pease Air Force Base in Newington, New Hampshire, had instructed the local police departments that if anyone had observed a UFO, they should report it to Pease Air Force Base. So Betty called the base. She spoke to them briefly that night, and then the next day they called back, and they spoke to Betty and Barney at length about their sighting. So the report was actually filed on September 21st, 1961.
Wow. And at that time, so the military, the Air Force, was involved.
Yes.
Was Blue Book active?
Yes, it was Project Blue Book. There was a Project Blue Book record report.
That's what that was?
Yes.
And was there at any time anyone trying to suppress any information, or was it allowed to come out in the public?
Well, it was very interesting. It didn't come out in the public for many, many years.
Really?
Dr. James McDonald, You might be familiar with him. He was the former co-chairman, had been chairman of the Department of Meteorology at the University of Arizona. And he was an avid researcher, probably the best UFO researcher that ever lived, incredibly bright man. And he found it in the Blue Book files. He found that report and gave that report to Betty. There was a very interesting thing about that report, and that is in the very first handwritten report, air intercept radar was checked off, leading me to believe that they might have scrambled a jet after this craft. There was a radar report that it appeared on radar at 2:14 a.m., and that would have been about the time that Betty and Barney were released from capture. So all of this is really intriguing to me, but there was a cover-up. They said that it was due to an atmospheric inversion, temperature inversion, ground clutter,
swamp
the
gas.
Planets, everything but swamp gas, you know, the planet Jupiter, an advertising light, you name it. It was list after list. In the end, they really could not identify what it was. They also initially stated that there was a strong inversion in the Lincoln, New Hampshire region that night. And so I was very curious about this. I wanted to know if it was a cover-up or if it was true. So I contacted the chief meteorologist at the Mount Washington Weather Station, and I also contacted a chief meteorologist for a television station and asked both of them to look into their archival records and to just let me know what the weather was like that night. I found that there was no inversion that night in the Lincoln, New Hampshire area. And the television meteorologist who looked in the archives at the U.S. Weather Service stated that, in fact, the conditions were just the opposite for an inversion.
Wow. Wow, isn't that something?
Yes.
Would you say that there's any other rumors or misinformation out there that should be cleared up? I mean, things that you hear over and over again that are perhaps not right.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
One of those things is I hear over and over again that Betty and Barney merely saw a light in the sky. I hear that Betty was an avid, lifelong UFO advocate or
enthusiast.
Enthusiast. That's that's the best word for it. That is totally false. I read over and over again that they didn't even entertain the idea that it might have been a UFO until Betty had a series of dreams 10 days later, and that all of the information came out of those dreams. It's totally false. I have the records. I just told you about how the reports that they made immediately on September 26, 1961, she sat down after reading her first book on UFOs and wrote a letter to the National Investigations Committee on Aerial Phenomena. And in that letter, she gave detailed information about what she and Barney observed. This was even before she had her first dream.
Wow. So this story didn't come out for several years. What was it like for you at that time, knowing this?
Well, I had to maintain secrecy, and I knew why. Betty and Barney were prominent people in the state of New Hampshire. She was a social worker for the state. He was very active in civil rights in the state. He was legal redress to the NAACP. He also was appointed by the governor of the state of New Hampshire to serve on the U.S. Civil Rights Committee, State Advisory Committee. He was Rockingham County Community Action Programs chairman of the board of directors. They had worked on a literacy program in the state for voters' rights. So the last thing they possibly could have wanted was to be associated with a UFO abduction or close encounter. You know, it would have destroyed their credibility. And when that became public as a violation of confidentiality, it was very upsetting to Betty and Barney and the family. We met as a family, and we discussed what they should do next.
How did it change their lives?
It really was very distracting for both of them, in a sense, because they were so committed to improving the conditions of people in the United States and in the state of New Hampshire.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was very distracting. They did a lot of radio and television programs then. The book, The Interrupted Journey, was published, and they had to promote that.
Mm-hmm.
Barney was very driven in the area of civil rights and politics. And I think if he had lived, he probably would have gone into politics. All of that was pretty much demolished by the announcement that they had been abducted by aliens.
Mm-hmm.
And it did refocus them and drove their life in a different direction.
I would think
where,
so.
In a sense, they became celebrities and appeared on television shows talking about their experience.
Mm-hmm.
It also reduced their credibility.
Right, right. Before I get into some other questions here, one last question on this. How accurate, the movie in 1975 made for TV with James Earl Jones, I thought he did a very good job.
I agree.
He's a great actor. How accurate would you say that movie was?
The major problem I have with that movie is it leads the viewer to believe that Betty and Barney had almost no conscious recall of their experience, when in fact the documented information that they provided in the very beginning clearly demonstrates that they consciously recalled everything except for the abduction itself.
Mm-hmm.
So I have a problem there. I thought it was a fantastic movie. I thought that James Earl Jones captured Barney's personality very well.
Hmm.
But Estelle Parsons really didn't capture Betty's personality. Betty was an assertive person. She had a very good sense of self-esteem. She was very intelligent. And I didn't care to see Betty portrayed as a little helpless 60s woman.
Ah, uh-huh. Now, when I spoke with Stanton Friedman a while back, he said that there's a show coming up, a movie coming up.
Yes, book, Captured, the Betty and Barney Hill UFO
yeah.
Experience, has been optioned
uh-huh.
by Bryce Zabel in Hollywood. And he is currently working on the screenplay for
wow.
a movie on our book.
Any idea if that's going to come out at some point? Any projection of date or
no, anything? No, there's no projection of date at this point.
Mm-hmm.
It's a fairly long process, and after the screenplay
probably, yeah.
is written, and then it has to be sold in Hollywood for a movie to be made. So
uh-huh.
I'm keeping my fingers crossed.
Yeah. I wonder who will play the parts this time.
I wonder.
Denzel Washington, maybe. You never
Could
know.
Could be. You never know.
Let's talk about some other landmark abduction cases.
Sure.
Now, Travis Walton. You know Travis?
Yes, I know Travis.
Yeah. And have you spoke to him at great length?
Yes, I have.
Wow. Can you talk a little bit about that and any other landmark cases that you'd consider?
Travis is a very credible man. There has been a lot of debunking information
mm-hmm.
Designed to destroy his case. But he is an upstanding man in his community. He's credible. And that case is so impressive because he was actually missing in the White Mountains of Arizona in November of the year. And he would have died from hypothermia if he had actually been on the ground. I've also spoken to Steve Pierce, who was with Travis, one of the members of that logging crew. And he expressed his concern to me that they were actually under suspicion for murder.
Right. Yeah.
And it was very upsetting to them. They hoped that Travis would be found. It was, they ended up taking lie detector tests. All of them, except for one, passed the lie detector test. And the one who didn't pass didn't fail either. It was equivocal because he became angry. He was afraid that he had been in trouble with the law before, and and he had an attitude about the police anyway. And so he simply decided not to continue with the lie detector test. It wasn't that he was lying. It's that he didn't continue. Eventually, all of them retook the ones that were equivocal, retook the lie detector test and passed. So that's pretty good evidence. You might say that with one lie detector test, it can't be used in a court of law. It really isn't valid. But when you get that many individuals taking lie detector tests and they all pass, I think that it's a pretty good indication that they're telling the truth.
So what are some other what you would consider landmark abductions?
Well, there was certainly the Charlie Hickson, Calvin Parker case in Pascagoula, Mississippi. I believe that was 1973. Two men fishing on the river, and a UFO came in and was hovering just above them, took them, floated them onto the craft, and gave them physical examinations, and then they were released. The important thing about this is that Charlie and Calvin were taken to the police station after this and placed in a room. They didn't know there was a tape recorder in the room recording their statements. They got down on their knees and prayed. They were so upset and frightened by the experience that they had. These men were not lying, just as Travis Walton was not lying in his case. There was a case of three women in Casey County, Kentucky. This happened only a couple of months after Travis Walton's abduction. Elaine Thomas, Louise Smith, and Mona Stafford. And they had been out to dinner and were driving home. It was about 10 o'clock at night, 10:30, driving home. And a craft approached them very rapidly. At first, they thought it was a plane in free fall, crashing to the ground. But it stopped right above their car. And then it moved over and traveled next to their car as they were driving down the highway. It projected a light inside their car that caused them to become hot and tingling. And then their car started to move 80 miles an hour forward. They couldn't control it. They tried to put on the brake. They couldn't control the vehicle. And then all of a sudden it stopped and it was being pulled backward. And it seemed to be bumping along something. The next thing they knew, they were several miles down the road coming into their hometown. They had conscious recall of observing this craft. It was also observed by other witnesses who said that they observed it as well. The women eventually underwent hypnosis. They all recalled having physical examinations on board the craft. Another important case in my estimation.
Between the time when Betty and Barney were abducted and the news of that was suppressed, had any other abduction happened before that was released?
Not that I'm aware of. Of course, there might be people today who are remembering abduction experiences in that time frame. But people today tend not to speak publicly about their abduction experiences because they have been attacked. They've lost their jobs. They've mm-hmm. lost their credibility. It just isn't a very good thing to do. So, yes, there are probably others in that time frame. And people come forward and talk to me confidentially quite often.
Really? Wow.
But the next publicly known case occurred in 1969 at the Buffledge Girls Camp in upstate Vermont. It was a girls' swimming camp. And the campers had gone to a swim meet that night. There were two counselors that were left at the camp. There was a water skiing instructor, a young woman who went to Smith College and was working there in the summer. And then there was a 16-year-old boy who cleaned up the equipment along the edge of the lake. It was the first time that they had actually had an opportunity to sit down and talk to each other, and they were out on the dock. It was dusk, and as they were looking out at the water on Lake Champlain, they saw what appeared to be what we think of as a mothership. It was this huge cigar-like craft, and out of that flew three discs. They zigzagged around a little bit, and then two flew in one direction, and one came toward them. The one that came toward them came above the water, and then it ascended vertically and then descended and plunged into the lake. Then it came out and moved along toward them and stopped about 15 feet away from them. They were just awestruck as they were looking at this craft. The 16-year-old boy remembered observing non-humans in the craft who seemed to send him the telepathic message that he would not be harmed, that they would be okay. And then the craft went just above the heads of the young man and the young woman. The young woman seemed to be in a state of shock. He pushed both of them down to the deck on this dock. And the next thing they knew, they heard voices. The girls had returned from the swim meet, and the craft was leaving, and they could see it flying away in the distance.
So there was a time lapse?
Another time lapse. It's usually about an hour and a half, 2 hours of missing time that people experience.
Right, right. I watched a show on UFOs and abductions, and there was a psychiatrist saying that the hypnotherapist was leading people into believing about these abductions. And what do you say to that speculation?
What I can say about that is look at the case of Betty and Barney Hill. Dr. Benjamin Simon was one of the leading psychiatrists in this country. He knew nothing about UFOs. He did not believe that Betty and Barney could possibly have encountered alien beings from another planet in our star system. And he attempted to lead Betty and Barney away from that idea. He hypnotized both of them separately for a period of 6 months. He imposed amnesia at the end of each session so they couldn't converse with each other. They couldn't contaminate each other's information. And they told the same story, and it was different in many respects from the story that Betty told about in her dream account of the UFO abduction. Her abduction was different from her dreams. So was Barney's. So here is an example of two individuals who were led away from the idea. They had no prior knowledge. They were the first. They had no prior knowledge of what an abduction was like. You can say that, well, yes, if someone today really wanted to be abducted and they had read everything they could possibly read on the subject, so they had detailed information about what it was like, and if they had a hypnotherapist who was very invested in the idea that this individual did have an abduction, it's possible that you could confabulate that sort of thing, but that certainly would be unprofessional. And people who work with abduction experiencers on a regular basis will not work with anyone generally unless there is convincing evidence that they actually have been abducted and that that person hasn't read everything there is to read about abduction.
Mm.
So there are safeguards in place.
Right, right. I know I said I wasn't going to ask you any more questions about Betty and Barney, but I just wanted to ask you one more thing.
Okay.
What was it like listening to all of those recordings?
Well, I can tell you that initially I think I felt traumatized by it as I listened to them re-experiencing the trauma of being taken by non-humans.
Mm.
So it was extremely difficult for me at first. Mm-hmm. And I've listened to those tapes dozens of times now. In fact, I transcribed every statement that they made for my book, Captured the Betty and Barney Hill UFO Experience. So now I can look at it without being distressed.
Mm-hmm.
But it was difficult at first.
Right. I'm sure it was. I'm sure it was. So what are you involved in these days?
Well, I am an independent abduction investigator and researcher. I'm working on another book on with Denise Stoner, who is Florida MUFON's chief investigator, on two very important abduction cases, and we're hoping that that will be published next year. We also are working on a research study on commonalities among abduction experiencers, and we have three questionnaires. They're posted on my website at Kathleen-Marden.com. One is a 45-question, multiple-choice questionnaire. It's pretty general. We're attempting to draw commonalities or identify little-known commonalities among abduction experiencers. Then there is a 16-question questionnaire that is more open-ended, fill-in type, on ET technology observed on the craft. And then there is one that's about 20 questions, and it's for people who have never had an abduction experience. We want to have a control group here, so we'll know that these commonalities are not common across the general population.
Wow. And it seems like there's like hundreds and hundreds of cases. Is that, or even is it thousands?
I would say thousands of cases across the world, around the world, and people are reporting the same information. Even though much of it isn't publicized, those of us who work within the field keep in certain information secret.
Mm. Wow. Now, have you ever had this happen where you start interviewing someone and realize that they're full of baloney and you walk away? Has that happened?
Well, I try to be polite, but I do interview many, many people, and sometimes it becomes apparent to me that the person is probably someone who would like very much to have had an experience and that perhaps their creative imagination is running away with them. But for the most part, that's not the case. Most people come to me very, very concerned. They've had a close encounter. They've had missing time. And after that initial close encounter, they might be taken from their homes.
Mm-hmm.
So it generally happens the first time is from an external environment, such as the car, camping, fishing, hunting, whatever.
Yeah.
And then after that, it's from the home.
What about people that are repeatedly abducted? Do you believe that's a real happening?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
And why
this
would you
seems
think
to be a long-term study.
The thing that comes to question in mind for me is you picture, like, say the aliens are coming from another star system to here, and they would go to the exact same place and abduct the same person. I'm just trying to figure.
Well, let's think about this for a minute, and let's think that They're probably not flying back and forth from their star system every time they come to abduct somebody. They're probably in large ships, either under our oceans or outside Earth's atmosphere. And they're probably living there in very large numbers. They might even be on one of our planets in a device where they make all of the energy they need. They can sustain life in that kind of environment and perhaps go back and forth between our planet and their planet very rarely or infrequently. Let's think about that. And then they just have their smaller models, and they bring those smaller models down when they're going to abduct a person. Now, we know that they are inserting implants into abduction experiencers. That happens over and over again. And it seems that they use these as tracking devices so that they can take the same person over and over again throughout their lifetime.
If you were to speculate, why would you think that they would want to see the same person twice?
Well, for one thing, we know that thousands of individuals have stated that they're being used for the extraction of reproductive material from ovum and sperm. And so they might want to take the same individuals for that purpose to grow fetuses on board their craft in tubes or cylinders. They take tissue samples from individuals. I'm not sure what they're using these tissue samples for, but people have sort of punch biopsy marks and wake up with patterned bruises and patterned needle mm-hmm. marks on their bodies. Mm. I can't tell you why they're taking the same individuals over and over again, but it's something that they are doing. Mm-hmm. They seem to be following genetic lines in many cases, where they will take the mother, move along the maternal genetic line, take the daughter, take the granddaughter, and so on and so forth. So they appear to be doing a longitudinal genetic study, maybe biological study, maybe sociological study.
Now, what's the oldest person you've ever heard of being abducted?
In my study, I believe I had a person who was very close to 80 years old.
Really?
Who has been abducted. As people grow older, they tend not to be abducted as frequently. This 80-year-old was abducted much earlier in her life and visited from time to time.
Now, you hear a lot of these people say that they floated right through the wall and like solid objects.
Yes.
And there's a lot of people saying that.
Seems impossible, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does.
Well,
the whole thing does.
I had to question that myself, and so I interviewed a theoretical physicist, and I asked him if mm-hmm. that was possible. And he said that, yes, it is. In fact, we have the math to do that, and we've done it on a very small scale in a laboratory. And what the ETs would have to do is, let's say, for example, their vibrational frequency was at a certain rate.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And let's say maybe it was higher than our own. Then in order to move us through a solid structure, they would have to change the vibrational frequency of the solid structure to match their own, and also the human's vibrational frequency to match their own.
Wouldn't it be easier to open the window?
It would be. And when that occurs, then you can move solid matter through solid matter. Mm-hmm. Now, why would they do that?
Mm.
And what impact does it have on the human body? I think that it's probably less risky to do it that way than to actually go into people's homes, to land their craft on the ground the way they did years ago and walk people out to the craft. The consequence, it seems, of what they're doing possibly is they're making people ill. And I can tell you that on the study that Denise Stoner and I are doing, nearly 40% of the abduction experiencers have a formal diagnosis of chronic fatigue and immune dysfunction syndrome, a chronic mononucleosis. Less than 1% of the general population have been diagnosed with that same disease.
Wow.
That's very significant.
Wow. You would think that it wouldn't be just one species of aliens abducting people, but perhaps from other star systems and other species.
Yes, that is correct. And abduction experiencers report the most prevalent species that have taken them are what we call the grays or zetas. And there are two different sizes. There is the 3 foot tall grays with the gray skin and very large heads and black shiny eyes. Then there are the taller ones that are 4.5 to 5 feet tall. The small ones seem to be the assistants. The taller ones are the escorts and the physicians. So you have the grays experiments. Then individuals often today report what they call a mantis type being. And the mantis type being seems to be highly telepathic, empathetic, very frightening to look upon, but people seem to have a positive attitude toward this being. They tend to be physicians and might work alongside the grays or the zetas.
Wow.
In what they're doing. They're much taller than the zetas. They might be 5.5 to 6 feet tall. And some people have reported that they seem to be able to fold their legs up, almost like, think of a grasshopper, to make themselves shorter. It's really bizarre to think of that. And they might even have an exoskeleton.
Mm-hmm.
There's another type,
good insect. Uh-huh.
The bad boys of the neighborhood, I call them. And those are the reptilians, or mm-hmm. the reptoids. And I receive mixed reports about them, and they tend to be about 5.5 to 6 or even 7 feet tall, frightening in their demeanor. They tend to engage in sexual activity with humans. That seems to be a focus with reptilians, and it's very, very distressing for people who are taken by them, who consider themselves to have been raped. Yet some people have even reported positive relationships with reptilian beings as well. Mm. A few have reported that to me.
Yeah. Well, we're just about out of time here, but I had one more question. Has anyone that you've ever talked to had received any telepathic message about where we're going as Earthlings and our planet or anything like that?
The messages that humans receive tend not to be very specific. People are shown images, either on screens, or these images are just projected into their minds where they see destruction. They see cataclysmic scenes such as volcanoes or tsunamis and that sort of thing. And then they've come to pass, as we know already. Some people are also shown what appears to be a distant planet that is brown and appears incapable of harboring life. And so I wonder if that is their planet.
Mm.
And that's one reason that perhaps they're probably living out somewhere in our solar system on a very large craft.
Mm-hmm. Wow, very interesting. Or that could be our planet in the future.
I suppose it could be, but yeah. I don't like to entertain that idea.
If we lose our magnetic sphere, however you say that.
Yes, our magnetic field.
Yeah.
If it collapses.
Yeah. This has been absolutely fascinating. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.
And you have a lot of things going on this year.
I certainly do. You can go to my website at Kathleen with a K, hyphen Marden, M-A-R-D-E-N. There is a list of the events that I'll be speaking at. There are articles that you can read. You can purchase autographed copies of my books and DVDs.
All right. Great. So this is Martin Willis with Kathleen Martin, and that's it for today.